This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Jobless claims are down, and the reason may be a bit unusual. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update for December 6th. I'm Duarte Geraldino. Is the world ready for American energy? What do Americans want out of the fiscal cliff negotiations? GM now sells more cars in China than it does in the USA and is now looking to grow in Southeast Asia. And don't have a job? Here's a plane ticket out of the country.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Tomorrow we're expecting the all-important monthly job report, but numbers released today show fewer Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. New claims fell for a third straight week. Initial claims dropped by 25,000 to a seasonally adjusted 370,000. That's according to the Labor Department. Joining us is our regular Thursday analyst, Diane Swank, chief economist at Mizuho Financial in Chicago. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
So jobless claims are down. Is that linked to Superstorm Sandy?
Absolutely. What we saw was Superstorm Sandy hit such a highly populated area of the U.S. country and disrupted so much economic activity, you actually saw a surge in claims in the wake of the storm. Now that things are trying to get back to normal, those claims have come off a bit. We're also seeing some repair and rebuilding get underway. The problem, of course, is the people that benefit from this sort of perverse stimulus from Sandy, because it's such a large populated area with a lot of damages, that will outweigh, of course, the losses, but it's a different group of people that get the jobs to repair and rebuild damaged properties than the people who lost hours work because their place of work was shut down.
Well, that's so unfortunate. Now, are you surprised at how long the storm's impact is lasting?
It's not as surprising given, the epicenter of the storm hit really this critical artery of the U.S. economy. That part in and of itself is four times the size of the area hit by Katrina in retail sales. This is nothing to say of other kinds of economic activity that happens in that part of the country. And the push, even with that, to try to get things up and running again has very large impacts on the downside as the storm disrupted things. And then we're going to get a snapback. But as I mentioned earlier, the snapback benefits a whole different group of people, sometimes in different regions.
A quick question for you. A new government report says the U.S. should export more of its natural gas. The report says it could give the U.S. economy a boost. Quickly, do you buy it?
Absolutely. I think one of the more interesting issues is we've moved from being a major gas consumer and a major energy consumer, and this is the cusp now of a whole new area where we're not only a producer but an exporter. It's a game changer in the world of certainly the energy arena, but also for the U.S. economy.
Thank you very much, Diane Swank, chief economist at Mizuho Financial.
Thank you.
And let's get to the numbers. The markets are generally up. The Dow is around 13,000. The NASDAQ is about 2,986 and the S&P 1,410. In global trading, stocks are higher this morning, up 0.1% in Singapore, more than 1% higher in Frankfurt. Smithfield Foods' second quarter profits beat estimates. The company reported earnings at 61 cents a share. Analysts had predicted they'd only make 45 cents. The company says margins rose and volumes grew in its packed meat business. And Apple famously produced much of its hardware in China, but that's about to change. The company just revealed plans to start producing some Mac computers here in the USA next year. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Apple CEO Tim Cook talks about the move in an interview airing tonight on NBC's Rock Center. Although Apple used to make computers here in the U.S., Cook suggests he views this as a startup operation.
The consumer electronics world was really never here. And so it's not a matter of bringing it back, it's a matter of starting it here.
The Apple chief tells NBC the U.S. needs to beef up its manufacturing skills so companies can find the workers they need. That's a point his late predecessor Steve Jobs had long promoted and even argued for over a dinner with President Obama. In October, Mr. Obama pushed the idea along during a debate with Mitt Romney.
If we're not training engineers to make sure that they are equipped here in this country, then companies won't come here.
Apparently, Apple is finding enough skilled labor to produce at least a small line of Mac computers. Cook didn't say where, but Bloomberg Businessweek reports Apple is set to spend $100 million next year to move those manufacturing jobs from China to the U.S. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We've all heard America's full of natural gas, trillions of cubic feet of the stuff. So why not export some of it and make money? Well, a new Energy Department report says that's exactly what the U.S. should do. And it finds there is a net economic benefit to exporting American natural gas. So why aren't we doing it? Marketplace's Scott Tong has been following this natural gas story and joins us. Hey there, Scott.
Good morning, Duarte.
So this is good news, right?
Well, here's the business case for it. America has a glut of natural gas right now. The American drillers and their new technology are actually victims of their own success. They have too much. And too much means the prices are relatively low right now. Now, overseas, the Europeans, they're paying twice as much per unit of energy for natural gas. And the Japanese are paying triple or more. So a lot of companies here have applied to export it. And this report gives the Energy Department an economic reason, at least, to say, yes, it's good for the economy. And it could also push up prices a little bit for gas, which would be better for the drillers' profits, Duarte.
Well, hold on. But what are the challenges, Scott?
Well, in energy, they talk about below-ground risk, as in the drilling, and they talk about above-ground risk, which is politics. Now, some environmental groups think that this locks us into fossil fuels for too long, and this involves the controversial drilling practice of fracking. There are also some domestic companies not happy. They like their natural gas cheap. Steel makers who want cheap energy, petrochemical firms who want cheap raw materials, so they lobby against this. In the end, there's also a question about the business model. This is a commodity business. There are very volatile prices, and transport costs are high. And if other countries pull off their own shale gas revolution, they may not need to buy ours.
Yeah, which is the big fear. Now, are we just talking natural gas, or is there something larger in the mix?
This is going to be all fossil fuels. Fracking works for oil, and there's increasing talk. We're going to get so much and talk about exporting that. And coal. Coal in America struggles to compete against cheap natural gas, but Europeans and the Asians, again, they'll pay a lot of money for it. So we will have more debates over infrastructure, pipelines, and licenses to get it out.
More debates to come. Thank you very much, Marketplace's Scott Tong.
You're welcome.
It appears the battle over what to do about the fiscal cliff is all about perception, perception, perception. Today, President Obama is trying to make his case by visiting a middle-class family in Northern Virginia to show how ordinary Americans will be impacted. There are only a few weeks left to go before a pack of steep tax hikes and budget cuts are set to go into effect. That is, of course, unless Congress and the White House can reach a deal. For more now on how the public views the debate, let's get an attitude check, our weekly partnership with the polling firm Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Joining us now is Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So fiscal cliff, that phrase fiscal cliff, at this point you even hear some toddlers saying it, but do you believe that most Americans understand what it is?
No, actually, when pollsters have asked Americans how well do you understand the implications of sailing off that cliff, the data show that the significant majority say no, they don't understand it very well. Some say, yeah, I have kind of an understanding, but in terms of people who say, yes, I understand it very well, that's 28% in one recent Washington Post Pew poll, as an example, who say they understand it very well. So in answer to your question, Americans, I don't think, claim to be fully cognizant of all what's going on in this cliff business.
So if most Americans, if we don't understand what the fiscal cliff is, what are your findings saying? How do we perceive all this back and forth in politics regarding the fiscal cliff?
Americans don't perceive it well at all. We saw a deterioration in ratings of Congress back in August of 2011 when we had the debt ceiling debacle. And now we're seeing very low ratings for the honesty and ethics of Congress, as an example, slightly above car salespeople at the very bottom of the list. Congress job approval ratings at 18%. One poll I saw back in November from September said they thought that elected officials in Washington were more likely to act like spoiled children in this debate than they were responsible adults. How's that for an interesting question? So all in all, Americans don't think very highly of what's going on in Washington. And the message to the elected representatives in all of our polling is compromise, get together and figure out how to solve this.
Right now, some people in Washington would say that Republicans are willing to negotiate, more so now that Mitt Romney is not headed for the White House. What's the perception of the Democrats, though?
The Democrats do better than the Republicans. I'll give you an example. We recently said, do you approve of how Obama's handling the fiscal cliff negotiations, the Democrats in Congress and the Republicans in Congress? Obama's on top, 52% approve of how he's handling it. Republicans are on the bottom, 27% in our Gallup poll approve of how the Republicans are handling the fiscal cliff, and 39% approve of the Democrats in Congress. So Obama's on top, and the Democrats don't do great, but they certainly do better than the Republicans.
Thank you very much, Gallup's editor-in-chief, Frank Newport.
My pleasure.
But there are some people who don't mind the state taking a bite out of their wallet, which brings us to New York, where state police are in a desperate search for a woman. What'd she do wrong? Well, being nice at Christmas. The woman approached a state trooper near Albany and gave him a holiday card. She was impressed with his work. When the trooper got home, he opened the card and found inside $1,000. But he can't keep it, hence the search. Police want to find this woman and ask her, where should we donate this money?
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
State governments are still getting paid from a 1998 settlement with the tobacco industry. This year, they're expected to collect $26 billion. That's record revenue, according to a report out this morning. But for all that cash, states are not expected to spend very much to help people quit smoking. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
They are always dramatic, and they've gotten sickeningly graphic.
3 months after you quit smoking, your lung function improves up to 30%. But right now, you're one day closer to emphysema.
Ads like that are also becoming much less frequent, according to a new study from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Even as states rake in record revenue from the landmark tobacco settlement, the report finds they're spending less than 2% of it on prevention, around $500 million a year. The group's Vince Wilmore says that doesn't come close to the $8 billion the industry still puts into marketing.
Tobacco companies spend more than $18 to encourage people to smoke. For every $1 the states spend to keep kids from smoking and help smokers quit.
Most of the $27 billion in settlement money and tobacco taxes is going instead to plug budget holes, and Wilmore says that's short-sighted. He says a recent study found every dollar spent on tobacco prevention saves states $5 in public health care expenses. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
GM now sells more cars in China than it does in the USA. As Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the company may soon look beyond China to the lucrative Southeast Asian market.
While businesses have been fawning over China, 600 million people throughout Southeast Asia have also been getting richer. U.S. automakers are beginning to take notice, says Michael Dunn, author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads.
Incomes are now at that sweet spot of just passing $4,000 per capita. That's when demand for cars takes off.
Indonesia and Thailand are the fastest growing markets in the region this year.
It will be a growth market and it can be highly lucrative for automakers.
Most of the cars you see on Southeast Asian roads are made in Japan, but GM's China president Bob Socha hinted to Reuters that he plans to change that. He's eyeing a possible partnership with GM's Chinese partner, SAIC, to assemble low-cost cars for the region. It may seem like an economic no-brainer, but GM's partnership with SAIC to sell cars in India has fallen on tough times. Sales there fell 21% the first half of this fiscal year. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And finally, don't have a job? Here's a plane ticket out of the country. That was New Zealand's strategy. The country was buying one-way airline tickets to Australia for its citizens so Kiwis could find work and to get them off subsidies. It was part of a transition to work grant program. To get the grant, applicants had to say what was keeping them from a job, to which many responded, this country. 16 people had their airfare paid by the program before it was canceled. In Los Angeles, I'm Duarte Geraldino. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.